What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there from Los Angeles. How are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I have an amazing interview with Peter Todd, recorded at Tonevay's Unconfiscatable Conference in Las Vegas. But first, I have a message from my show's sponsors. So first up, my friends from BlockFi, who've been sponsoring the podcast since September and have now extended to May. So why should you care about BlockFi? Why do they keep advertising on the podcast? Why have they extended twice? Well, they provide the most trusted crypto-backed loans on the market, and they know that this show has proper Bitcoin people listening. So whether you need a crypto-backed loan today or sometime in the future, they want you to come to them first. And they are doing everything to be the best in the market globally. Yes, they service clients across the globe and are in 47 US states, and their interest rates start as low as 4.5%. Sign up today at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid and you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000. And applying takes less than 2 minutes. That is blockfi.com, which is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. And if you like the What Bitcoin Did podcast, you should definitely check out the Transatlantic Cable podcast from Kapersky Lab. They look at cybersecurity issues that affect everybody and also make sure that the podcast fits into your busy day by keeping it to less than 20 minutes. Check it out and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from by searching for the Transatlantic Cable podcast. So, on to my interview with Peter. Definitely an interview I've wanted to do for a long time. Peter's long and influential history in Bitcoin is undeniable, but he also has a great perspective on many things. Thankfully, when I was in Vegas, I got the chance to sit down and talk to him about all things Bitcoin. And I also need to say a big thank you to Giacomo for helping facilitate this. We talk about the essence of Bitcoin, why it worked when other attempts at digital currencies failed, and Peter's work on open timestamps. I absolutely love this interview. I hope you do too. And if you have any questions, you know you can reach out to me. I also need to say thank you to my Patreon top tier sponsors. Firstly, Elite Crypto Consulting, your personalized trading teacher. Thank you guys for supporting the podcast. Secondly, you need to check out vidyen.com, WordPress plugins for advertising and Monero mining reward sites. That is vidyen.com, and Honeyminer, who makes mining and earning simple for anyone with a computer. Thank you, patrons. Thank you for supporting the show. Okay, so on to the interview. If you have any questions, then feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Hi there, Peter. How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Thank you for coming on the podcast. I've wanted to talk to you for quite a long time. I followed a lot of your work, and one of the things that really stood out for me is I went on your blog, and not only did I not understand the content of your articles, I didn't even understand what they're about. Like, there's a certain level of technical competence that I think you have to have to kind of understand this work. And I then read about a story that you were emailing Hal Finney and Adam Back when you were like 15?
Yep.
I've got to ask about this. What's the background? How does a 15-year-old start talking to Hal Finney and Adam Back about Hashcash? What's the journey to that?
Well, you know, the great thing with the internet is no one knows that you're a dog, and even when they do, they don't care. You know, and I mean, if you go back far enough, you know, as a young kid, I watched a lot of Star Trek and thought, you know, the ideals of democracy and freedom of speech, they all sounded well and good. And, you know, my dad's actually an economist by training. So, you know, initially, really early on, I got interested in the Freenet Project, which is a decentralized, censorship-resistant publication network. Long story short is it lets you make a website that no one can take down. You know, it lets you publish. And I thought, oh, that's really cool, and got interested in it, did a little bit of work on it. Actually, first time I kind of worked on creating exploit was actually against Freenet Network. I created a tool to go and map out the interconnections of different nodes. So, you know, those all well and interesting. But I think the big issue with Freenet Network was I was thinking to myself, well, obviously the next step is you need decentralized money. You know, just being able to publish your thoughts isn't enough. Political movements need money. You know, particularly political movements for the marginalized, the poor. You know, if you're a rich person, you have the way of funding the things you need to fund to make your political movement happen. Whereas the poor don't have that. You know, we often kind of talk about it in reverse, saying, oh, you know, the rich people are getting into politics and so on. When, you know, reality, I mean, you can't kind of stop that. But for the disadvantaged, you definitely need that option be able to move money around, and you need to be able to do it without surveillance. So I think long story short is somehow or another I wound up on a mailing list, the Blue Sky mailing list, which if I remember correctly was advertised on the Freenet mailing list, So I signed up and we started talking about stuff. And I spent a lot of time trying to invent Bitcoin and, like many people, completely failed at it. And it's really interesting looking back and seeing just how wrong I was, in almost 180 degrees opposite what was the right answer. And a lot of people, I think, had that experience.
So you tried to invent a Bitcoin?
Yeah, I was one of many, many people trying to create decentralized currency and really failed at it.
What was your version?
Well, I didn't have a proposal because I realized all my thoughts on it weren't going to work. But I think what I got so wrong was I had thought about Hashcash in terms of the thing that controls, you know, the creation of money. And that's not actually an important thing. The creation of money is not the important thing. It's preventing double spending, that is. You know, the creation is just a one-time event. Allowing money to be moved consistently and accurately without double spends is actually the critical thing. And unfortunately, because I tied proof of work to the creation so tightly, I never really came up with the concept of, well, hang on, no, we tie proof of work to the changes in the ledger to make sure it's difficult to rewrite the changes.
Right.
And my thinking on my kind of solution, well, all right, we have some kind of decentralized database. How do you do that? No, it can be attacked. You know, it can be civil attacked. And I just constantly shot down ideas and could never figure out, well, how do you make this work? When the answer was just so simple, but it was 180 degrees opposite what I was working on.
But I'm guessing you're saying it's simple because the answer was Bitcoin, right?
I mean, literally, someone could have sat down. Like, honestly, it's to the point where one tweet from the future saying how Bitcoin worked would probably be enough info for me to have created Bitcoin.
But what is the key, the one key element then?
Using proof of work to make changes to the ledger difficult. Like, that one sentence, I think, encapsulates the key part of Bitcoin that we were missing back then.
So it's more the game theory than the code.
I don't even think the game theory part is the really critical thing. Like, the absolute core of it that you must have is tying proof of work to changes to the ledger to make it expensive to change. You know, you could probably have Bitcoin without even a financial reward, and it would still work far better than any of the crazy ideas people had come up back then.
So the Bitcoin white paper comes out. You're obviously aware of it. You read it. Is it obvious at the time?
Or
is
absolutely.
It, oh, yeah. Immediately.
Yeah, you've clicked. Yeah. For me, I believe I read the Bitcoin white paper for the first time, like late 2009. And I remember, you know, when I read it, I was like, oh, shit, I should have thought of that. You know, it was actually, for me, it was the opposite of many people. For me, I read it, and this is obviously going to work. And only later did I come up with reasons why it wouldn't.
Right.
Whereas for many people, they read and think, how would this ever work? And then later, they're convinced it does. But, you know, I'd been primed because I'd already worked on this and tried very hard. So when I saw it, it just was so obvious to me. Oh, I was wrong. This was the missing piece.
How, as a 15-year-old, do you make the leap from realizing that there is a need for money to finance certain projects and things to it must having to be a decentralized type of money that doesn't even already exist? How do you make that leap?
I mean, the idea of e-money and cypherpunk stuff around that was not exactly like an unknown concept. You know, I probably even read sci-fi stories at the time talking about that. You know, the notion of credits is really sort of a common term in sci-fi stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, and also like money itself has a property. I mean, sure, it's issued by the government, but, you know, paper money I can give to you and no one can stop me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, The idea that money would have to be controlled on a transaction basis is this very new thing pushed by big companies who want to go make money off this and law enforcement who would like to surveil everyone. You know, this is the opposite of how money should work. This is not the status quo.
So has Bitcoin worked then? Or is it working?
I mean, in terms of doing what money should do, it's a hell of a lot closer than, say, PayPal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a lot closer than what PayPal was meant to be. I mean, people who started PayPal wanted to create, you know, censorship-resistant e-currencies. They weren't, you know, they didn't have the tech to do it, and they didn't have the legal frameworks to get away with it, so they didn't. But that was the initial concept with PayPal. So, you know, Bitcoin's a lot closer to that. I mean, Bitcoin has scalability problems, but the core thing of what Bitcoin does is much closer to that than alternatives. You know, certainly closer to things like Liberty Reserve, which of course got shut down.
Yeah. I guess there's always been the centralized problem, right?
Yeah. Centralization kills things.
Yeah.
You know, if they have adversaries. Often centralization is the way to go. I mean, I have a project myself called Open Timestamps, which is absolutely centralized. You know, there are four calendars in the Open Timestamp system. I run two of them, two other people run another two. It's a centralized system. But Open Timestamps doesn't really have adversaries, you know, in this way that Bitcoin does. You know, no one's going to profit by shutting down Open Timestamps in the way you would with Bitcoin. And also, because Open Timestamps relies on Bitcoin for the truth of the timestamps, the central third party is not in a position to fake things.
Okay, so I should have asked this at the start. I love asking this question because it's so simple. And the first time I heard it was when Epicenter asked Adam Back. And the answer blew my mind just hearing it set out. So I'm just going to ask you again. What is Bitcoin? The answers are always different as well.
Well, I'll give you a different answer.
Okay.
Which is, Bitcoin is a shared data structure that we make artificially expensive to change by destroying energy every time we update it.
Yeah, I've had that one like four times. No, I'm joking. Yeah, try harder. Yeah, I'm only joking. Okay, okay.
All right, Bitcoin is an elephant and it's pink with like little spots.
I love the energy angle. So you've been around since the start, right? It's 10 years. And
not quite.
Pretty much.
I mean, I've known about Bitcoin
since
nearly the start, but I actually got more active into it a bit later. And the reason is, I mean, relative to many other developers, but the reason is because when I first learned about Bitcoin, well, I just started a new job at a crazy startup. And then I was crazy enough to then also try to do a physics degree while I was at the startup. So I didn't exactly have a lot of free time.
But I mean, I've gone through the exercise of going through old mailing lists and old Bitcoin Talk forums, and you know, there's a number of names I recognize, a number I don't, and I've seen you in there commenting and talking. So you were there like pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, I started working on this stuff full time 2014, which is a lot earlier than many people.
But having been there through the whole experience, like, how do you take it all in? Because even though you knew it would work. There's a difference between knowing theoretically it would work.
Well, remember, I thought it would work.
You thought it would
and
work.
And then I started realizing, hang on, this isn't as good as it sounds.
Right, okay, we're going to come back to those things. But 10 years on, it still exists. It holds billions of dollars in value. We at one point hundreds of billions. There is the talk of ETFs. We have futures. We have so much happening. Did you foresee all this?
I mean, to be perfectly honest, this doesn't really surprise me that much.
Okay.
You know, I mean, you always got to be a bit careful. I mean, your memory of what you thought 5 years ago can be a bit vague. But I don't think if you'd asked me that many years ago, would it, you know, could it get to where it is now? I would have said no. I think I would have said, yeah, I mean, this is plausible. You know, it is an obvious utility. You know, digital gold is obviously useful. So if things don't fail and, you know, it continues to grow, I mean, surely it could get to this point. I think the more interesting question is, well, how big could it get? And I would actually put relatively small limits on it. You know, we're not going to see, like, first time I bought Bitcoin, I bought it for 20 cents a Bitcoin.
Right.
And I tell you, that was the best financial decision of my life. The worst financial decision of my life was only buying $20 worth.
Hold on, what is that? That's like 100 Bitcoin. Yeah. 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 But we will have hindsight, right?
But, you know, the thing with that is looking at how that grows. I mean, how many zeros is that? Call it 10,000 times growth or whatever, you know, depending on what price you pick. We're not going to get another 10,000. The world economy is too small for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not that far away from having more money in Bitcoin than in the US dollar and gold combined. You know, that's, if I remember correctly, it's like 100x.
Yeah.
That's pretty, you know, that's a lot smaller than 10,000x.
Yeah, but I'm not convinced you care that much about price beyond the wider kind of PR it garners and brings people into the system. I don't see you as somebody that incentivized by the price.
Well, I mean, price is a funny thing because people often say, you know, the price doesn't matter. And that's definitely not true. Bitcoin security model relies on it being valuable. There is no getting around that. You know, it probably would not work if the price was, say, 1,000 times less. Someone would probably attack it for kicks and giggles.
So you were saying you started to look at the reasons why it won't work. What were the main issues that you found? And were there things you attempted to try and break?
Well, you know, really, like, the one big thing for me was when I realized, oh, yeah, scalability really matters and this stuff doesn't scale.
Right.
You know, and I figured that out, you kind of say embarrassingly late, but in terms of, like, how long I was looking at Bitcoin seriously, fairly early, you know, from the time I started looking at Bitcoin seriously to when I realized this and how important it was, you were probably talking like 3 or 4 months, you know, and that was while I was at a startup doing a university degree at the same time. You know, simple truth is I just didn't pay that much attention to it for quite a few years. And when I realized that, well, I got very active in trying to solve this problem. And I also importantly got very active in debating people who thought it wasn't an issue.
So were you debating Roger?
Well, he wasn't around then.
Oh, like you were on about earlier. Okay, so who would be debating this?
Gavin Andresen, actually. I literally debating Gavin Andresen on Bitcoin Talk forums was probably the thing that got my name out there.
Right, okay.
Because there is a thread on Bitcoin Talk where I disagree with Gavin Andresen and it just spiraled.
And what, the disagreement was what, block size?
Exactly.
Okay, yep. So what did he want?
You know, his viewpoint was, yeah, you can, if I remember correctly, his exact viewpoint was you can have an unlimited block size. And that was just such an extreme position. I laid out very carefully why this did not work. And, you know, it wasn't the first time there'd been a disagreement on that. But at least for me personally, that was the time when, hey, this is Peter Todd, the guy who disagrees with Kevin Andresen on this. And he seems to have good points. You know, that's really why my name got known. And things just built on there.
But there's different reasons why, or people give different reasons for why a larger block size won't work. Some people I've heard discuss it because it doesn't scale in computer power.
Remember,
because of nodes.
Gavin's view there was an unlimited block size. He thought the incentives were such that miners would voluntarily restrict the size of their blocks, even though they could make biggest blocks they want. And I laid out basically with, you know, a bit of math and game theory why this is a bad idea. You know, that wasn't even like a bigger picture. It's just, this is broken because miners can do this. When they create a bigger block, they're going to push out their competitors. That, you know, that's kind of the argument in a nutshell.
Right.
And the simple reality was, I was right on that. You know, and that's just so well supported by academic research since. And Gavin was just dead wrong.
And has he ever come back and said, no, you were right?
Nope.
Okay.
I mean, there's a reason why he's no longer involved in Bitcoin in any real sense. He just wasn't competent enough to do it.
Yeah, there's probably more than one reason as well, right?
You know, supporting Craig Wright was probably not the best move, but all that stems from the fact he just isn't that competent to what he was doing.
And I guess it requires a certain level of competency to be able to work at that level, and it doesn't feel like there's a lot of people at that level.
No, definitely not. No, most programmers in general do not have the capability to work on this stuff because they don't think it adversarially. You know, it's a tough thing for people to imagine. You know, most people are just not used to imagining, all right, what are the bad things that could happen?
Yeah.
Whereas, for whatever reason, I and a few other people are good at that. I'm quite happy to imagine all the ways people could screw people over.
What do you make of Luke's ideas around a smaller block? Is it 300K?
You know, I think his technical arguments for that are good, but I think he doesn't understand the social side of that, which essentially makes it impossible. And after all, I mean, let's face it, Luke is a crazy evangelical Catholic. He has very, very, very strong beliefs about, you know, that are ultimately driven by very strongly held principles. You know, he is to us, an evangelical crazy Catholic, but that comes from him having very well-defined beliefs and very strongly held principles. And the logical conclusion of that is, you know, his belief system. And I think what Luke, I'm not even sure I could say that he fails to see, because he may very well understand this perfectly, but, you know, why Luke would say something like that is, He has the principles and he takes it to its conclusion. Whereas the way I'd put it is, yeah, I mean, he's not wrong, but it just ain't going to happen.
Right, okay. Where do you envisage the block size being in the future? Do you think it's always going to stay as it is, or do you think at some point there will be a change?
Oh, I think it's plausible, actually, for the rest of the life of Bitcoin. We're not going to see another block size increase. And the reason why I say that's plausible is ultimately things like Lightning and whatnot work pretty well. And the what would it be right now, like 15 transactions per second or something, is actually a fair amount. You know, and the way people use Bitcoin, like after all, for Bitcoin to be wildly successful doesn't necessarily mean that people are actually making payments on it. Bitcoin as a store of value can be an incredible success story. I think the bigger threat we would have is actually Bitcoin's inflation schedule. Because in the long run, you know, and this isn't a short-term thing, but this is like 10, 20 years down the future, there might not be enough inflation to pay for security.
Well, I just wrote that down, actually. So I've got a couple of questions about that. So if it's just a store of value and there isn't enough Bitcoin being moved around for fees and the miner rewards have dropped, that's a huge risk for the security of Bitcoin, right?
Absolutely.
And
but that's a risk like 10, 20 years in the future. That is a very long time. And by then, who the hell knows what the risks are?
But Peter Todd thinks adversarially. And I think that goes into the basket of things that you probably are thinking about now.
Yep. Let me look this way. If I were able to go back in time and redo Bitcoin, because of course I am Satoshi, as is everyone else.
I've read it. I've read you invented Bitcoin at 12.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if I was able to go back in time and create Bitcoin from scratch, I would have made it have a perpetual, say, you know, 0.5% or 1% inflation rate.
Okay, that's controversial for some people.
Well, look at it this way. If you can't afford like a 0.1% or 0.5 or even a 1% inflation rate, what the fuck are you doing with your life? It's 1% a year. So what?
So who have you discussed that with? And like, you don't have to name names, but like, have you discussed that with people? What's the general reaction? Because there's no reason for that not to be introduced in the future, right? I mean,
I think the general reaction is, well, first of all, Bitcoin right now has what, a 4% inflation rate? You know, we're a long way from any of this discussion being relevant.
Mm.
So I think the general reaction right now is, you know, it's push it to the future. It's just not a discussion worth having right now. It's a bunch of drama. And of course, you look at my Twitter account and I don't shy away from that. But most of the development community wouldn't really want to touch the issue. And I think they're right. There's no reason to touch this issue till it actually matters.
What about if Lightning Network is hugely successful and people stop using the base chain because, you know, Lightning is fast, it's cheap, it's instant. Could we get to the point where there's no argument to use the base chain because Lightning is as trusted as the base chain? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Well, I mean, Lightning's security model is more risky than the base chain. You know, it just doesn't. I mean, Lightning, there's good reason to use it beyond, you know, scale. I mean, Lightning is a much better UI experience.
Mm-hmm.
But the simple reality is the Lightning security model is more dangerous than Bitcoin itself, assuming that you're able to wait for confirmations. You know, under certain cases, Lightning can actually be much more secure. I mean, if I go pay you with Lightning, the security of that payment from the point of view of being reversed 10 seconds from now is far better than the main chain ever could be. And in fact, it'll be better probably, an hour or two into the future. But overall, like if you're making big payments that aren't time sensitive, the main chain's better security. On the other hand, you know, this idea of like Lightning taking away transaction fees, that's not unique to Lightning. Tons of things do this. Exchanges do this. Probably the most payment volume that happens is actually on exchanges. You know, Liquid sidechain does this as well. Liquid takes transaction fees away from the main chain. You know, there's no end of things that take transaction fees away from the main chain. And the inflation argument I'd give is very simple. It's, well, make sure you always have this mechanism to ensure that the chain keeps marching forward. You know, even with transaction fees, you actually need this for kind of subtle game theory technical reasons. You know, the simple reality is Bitcoin without inflation subsidy has a much worse security argument than Bitcoin with inflation subsidy, even if you have transaction fees paying for things.
I haven't heard you talk about this a lot, though, right? So are you waiting? Is it a case of priorities? Deal with what needs to be dealt with now. And you'll bring this up in 10 years. I mean,
it just isn't relevant for literally like another 10 years or so.
What about 10-minute blocks across the solar system, though? When's that going to be a pressing issue? I read that.
Well, yeah, so I did a talk, actually. I believe the title of the talk was Solar-Powered Space Miner. Solar-Powered Space Pirates, a Threat to Bitcoin. And the simple answer to that is yes, if space travel becomes cheap enough that big mining operations are operating far enough away from Earth that the speed of light gets people out of consensus, yeah, Bitcoin's fucked and we'll probably have to increase the block control.
So are you a general evil?
Yes, I'm a bad person capable of love.
Okay, outside of Bitcoin, because a lot of Bitcoiners are very maximalist in nature, but I have seen you talk about Zcash and Ethereum. Like, what's your position on alternative coins and alternative currencies?
Well, the thing is, I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist. I'm a maximalist. You know, anyone who understands economics and finance, you know, and how markets work will be a maximalist, because it is more efficient to have one currency than a whole bunch of different ones. You know, that's just not a controversial opinion. I mean, it's a controversial opinion among scammers who want you to go buy their ICO. But, you know, standard, non-scam-driven, like, economic thinking, this is not a controversial opinion. You know, this is how the euro got created. And there are certainly downsides to not having multiple currencies. You know, the one-world currency thing has a lot of very real economic problems. But they're not problems that apply to things like Bitcoin. For digital payments in a decentralized environment, it's just natural to end up with one coin. Whether or not it's actually Bitcoin, who the heck knows, but Bitcoin's technical design and sort of technical ethos currently is definitely the most suitable to being the one currency everyone uses. You know, that's just a matter of like simplicity, reliability, you know, of disinterest in making deep, dangerous changes. And there's just, you know, conservatism is a good thing for that store of value. It's just a pretty obvious set of combinations that mean Bitcoin's kind of the default there.
But therefore, is it good to have competing alternative currencies?
I mean, it's not going to hurt things, but for the most part, the competing alternative currencies are scams.
Every single one?
Well, some are more scammy than others.
Is Ethereum a scam?
You know, Ethereum is a funny example because the way it was launched and the way it was promoted, that's much more of a scam than like any of the sort of currency itself. You know, had Ethereum, for instance, been launched, I mean, it's hard to kind of come up with an example where this would be possible. But let's suppose hypothetically somehow they launched Ethereum where it was just a, you know, add-on to Bitcoin, where somehow the people behind Ethereum were making money off of it. You know, this isn't really technically feasible, but let's assume for sake of argument it was. It would still wind up being a scam, even without a separate currency, because they were advertising things that they knew would not be possible. You know, Ethereum is just a bed of lies, if you will. You know, and I think it's very unfortunate because it also means a lot of academics, because they can get grant money from this and because Ethereum is easy to experiment on. I think it's pulled down the ethical standards of academia. You know, and it's just an unfortunate position to be in. And this is also, I mean, maybe a good way to explain this is the private chain side of things. While some of that's perfectly reasonable, a lot of the more grandiose claims made are effectively scams. And it's sort of a new, interesting category of scam where it's not like we're directly ripping people off, but rather we're lying about what our products can actually do, and we're getting away with it because it's security. And in security, well, I can sell you a magical rock that keeps lines away. How do you know it doesn't work? There's no lines around.
So what are the main claims for Ethereum then that you think are false?
I mean, it's a funny one because it's tough to pin down because the main claims were designed to be vague. You know, claims like this is a world, like a great example, sort of the world computer thing. What does that actually mean? You know, when you start thinking about it, any reasonable interpretation of it is, no, this is total bullshit. But it's presented in a way which is vague enough, it's tough to argue against. You know, you got to pin people down on, well, what does a world computer mean? What's it actually computing? Now, you ask a normal person, they think, oh, yeah, computation's done somehow on Ethereum, and it's, no, that's not how it works at all. you know, your Ethereum node redoes the computation. It's not a computer, it's a verifier. Whereas the sort of general, you know, way of building consensus applications I push is client-side verification, which is quite explicit. Yes, we have this big data set that your computer verifies. And other people don't even have to verify the data. They don't even necessarily know what it means. They may never even have a copy of it. But if I want to convince you that something's true, like I just sold you a house, I give you the data to prove it's true. And you verify that data yourself, and you come to the conclusion that, yes, you now own a house, or no, I'm trying to defraud you. That is a sane way to talk about blockchains. A world computer is not. A world computer is pie in the sky scam material. You know, and even Vitalik, I mean, he's kind of admitted, well, you know, the world computer stuff was a bit of a red herring. I'm sorry, the moment you say red herring and please go and invest in my thing, you're probably scamming someone.
I don't get the feeling he intentionally scammed somebody.
You know about his quantum computing thing?
No, tell me.
Well, just prior to Ethereum, he was involved in a quantum computing scam.
Okay.
And essentially what the scam was they would do simulated quantum computing that would somehow be better than anything else. It just didn't make any sense. And his claim is, oh, you know, I was kind of young and just, you know, had higher hopes for it and so on. No, you weren't that stupid. You know, first of all, you were like 19 in university. You knew what this was. You knew this was bullshit. Yeah, the guy's got the mind of a scammer, basically. You know, he's got the intentions of a scammer. He's very clever about it. He's not someone who, you know, is careless. He's not someone who gets himself clearly involved in a scam in the way that he can prosecute. But he's pushing dishonest stuff. I mean, that's what scammers do.
So ETH2, I'm guessing you've read some of the specs.
I mean, it's one of those things where you just go put up a whole bunch of complex shit on the wall to try to be resistant to criticism. You know, I believe Greg Maxwell is the one who deserves credit for this, but he's pointed out how the general approach of the Ethereum crowd is they put something out, it gets shot down because it doesn't work. So rather than go back and fix the problems, they make it more complex. And if you keep repeating this, eventually you appear to be secure, not because you've actually created something secure, but rather you've created something sufficiently complex. It's just too much work to criticize.
Next up, I talked to Peter Moore about what makes Bitcoin work, but first I have a message from my show sponsors. So, BlockFi, one of a handful of companies that I am excited about. I love a company which is creating value in the crypto space, one which has customers, one which is moving the Bitcoin and crypto ecosystem forward. BlockFi is bridging the gap between cryptocurrencies and the real world, something which is definitely needed. I finally got myself a bank account a couple of weeks ago. I mentioned this before. I'd been rejected by 6 banks, which was an absolute nightmare, and it was all because my business touches crypto. I believe companies like BlockFi are going to be changing this, and they're going to be making it easier for people to get bank accounts when the traditional system doesn't help. BlockFi isn't just a loans business though. With the additional $4 million they raised in finance at the end of last year, they are looking to create a suite of products. Crypto credit cards are coming, and they also have a crypto savings account which earns interest coming. Pretty cool. So you got to make sure you keep an eye out on BlockFi because they are one of the most important companies in the space. And listen, if you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender in the US, servicing over 47 states, but they also service customers worldwide. BlockFi accepts Bitcoin, Ether, or Litecoin as collateral. Customers can be funded in USD or GUSD, which is Gemini's dollar-backed stablecoin, and you can go from application to funding in as little as 30 minutes. If you sign up at BlockFi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans under $10,000 or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000. And applying takes less than 2 minutes. You know the drill. Check them out at BlockFi.com/whatbitcoindid, which is BlockFi.com/whatbitcoindid. And I've also got Blinkist advertising again, which is pretty cool. So do you know these? Funny enough, I was using Blinkist before they became an advertiser. With so many great business books out there that you want to read or books that people suggest and you don't have the time to get through them all, well, Blinkist has an app which solves this by condensing down the best takeaways and need-to-know information from thousands of non-fiction books into a 15-minute read. I use Blinkist when researching my work, as I am able to find the most useful bits from a book quickly and efficiently. And they also have crypto books, including Nathaniel Popper's Digital Gold and The Age of Cryptocurrency by Paul Vigner and Michael Casey. And guess what? They have a special offer for the listeners of the podcast. If you head over to Blinkist.com/WBD, you can get a 7-day free trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/WBD to start your 7-day free trial. Yeah, I mean, I read James Presswich's Medium post recently looking at ETH2. I don't know if you saw it.
I might have.
I mean, and I could, the only thing I could think of when I was reading this is this just seems insanely complicated.
Yeah.
Way of creating a distributed database.
Yeah.
I was reading about sharding, and then I was reading about state rent, and that certain things would be on chains. And I was just thinking, what's this for?
Yeah.
I like, just can't get my head around for it.
It is designed to be sufficiently complex that you can't criticize it. Now, on the other hand, if I wanted to explain to you how open timestamps works, I could do that in a morning, including the part where I explain how hash functions work. You know, it is dead simple. If I want to explain to you how my Proof Marshall project works, I'd probably have to go spend the afternoon as well. You know, this stuff is designed to be dead simple. I mean, this is why on my Twitter profile for a long time, the pinned tweet was a blockchain is a chain of blocks.
I knew that was covered.
Yeah. You know, blockchains are not complex things. People try to make them complex things so they can go sell you stuff, or in the case of academics, go and, you know, write papers and make them relevant. But they just aren't that complex.
Yep. And they have one purpose. Like Jimmy talks about this a lot. It's the blockchain serves a really good purpose for Bitcoin and money.
Yeah.
Nothing else really. And I've tried.
I actually disagree on that.
Well, that's good because I've tried to be open minded and tried to kind of just be as open minded as I can. Say, okay, is there something else here? Like,
well, you got to remember, because I define a blockchain as a chain of blocks, I would actually have the viewpoint that, yeah, blockchains are worth adding basically anything. I mean, the moment you have a data structure where you even want to create a backup of it, you might as well throw a blockchain in there so you can update it and ensure you have a complete copy. You know, my Open Timestamps project, it's a centralized system that creates timestamps, long story short. Well, one of the issues with it is if the central servers go down, you want to have a backup of all the timestamp proofs it made. How do you make that backup? Well, currently, you go and go through this HTTP, you know, RPC, RESTful protocol, total bog standard stuff, and you just download one after another. How do you know that your copy of the backup is the same as mine? Well, obviously, you're going to add hashing to it. Well, how are you going to add hashing to it? Well, why don't you go and make updates and have one update hash another? Oh, what do you know? We've created a blockchain.
Created a blockchain, yeah. Okay, so I met with Zach Prince of BlockFi, and we had a long chat about Bitcoin. They do crypto-backed loans, and it's a kind of it's a market that makes sense. But he also said it doesn't make sense when they're lending money, say, into Argentina, that if you've got to lend out Bitcoin because it's volatile. He said it makes sense to do a stablecoin. Stablecoin's built on Ethereum. So whether it's a scam or not, the fact that people are building things that people are using, how do you sit with that?
Well, so a point I'd make there is the stablecoins built on top of Ethereum, from a tech perspective, that can actually be the right decision. And the reason why that can be the right decision is, yeah, I mean, the infrastructure is there. You know, we can throw together something. It doesn't work as well as it could. But the tooling's there. We can get it done.
Yeah.
Push it out the door. You know, I've literally told clients of mine, well, you actually might want to build this on Ethereum because alternatives don't exist yet. We know they can exist. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the effort to actually make it work hasn't been done yet. And all equally, I'd say the stablecoin idea is just an obvious no-brainer. You know? You might want to have exposure to this currency. Why wouldn't you want to have some nice digital way of doing it with a well-defined trust relationship? It's just not, you know, it's just not a complex thing to talk about. It's has very obvious reasons to, in much the same way as like having an ETF makes a lot of sense for certain people. Now, having an algorithmic stablecoin where you try to do consensus decentralized magic to keep the price stable, there's pretty good reason to think those are impossible, will never work. But a trusted stablecoin where you have a central issuer who you have, you know, you have legal mechanisms to ensure that you get your money back. Yeah, I mean, why not? Hell, in some cases, a stablecoin that's actually a total fraud can actually make sense. You know, if I'm a trader and I want to temporarily move out of a position into a stable thing and then move into another position, even if the stable coin is a total fraud and there's no, you know, US dollars or whatever backing it, it can still be useful for me as a trader because my risk of the stable coin going belly up and the fraud, you know, playing out may be less than the risk I have of not moving my currency, you know, not moving my assets into that stable currency for whatever reason I needed to.
Yeah, I kind of see a world in crypto where I only see the two use cases. I see Bitcoin and a stable coin. That to me is pretty much all I think we need. Personally, I mean, you probably can think of some great other examples.
Well, if you're talking about money,
yeah,
and things related to money, I think you're a lot more right than people would want you to be.
Yeah, well, do you know why? Because other people want to invent other uses for a blockchain because they want to monetize it, and other people want to shoot down stablecoins.
Yeah, I guess the way I'd put it is, if there's a money component involved, I think you're relatively right. If there's not a money component involved, and we're just trying to do something related to some asset or some data structure, which for whatever reason we want consensus over, I mean, yeah, blockchains basically always make sense. But that's because a blockchain is just a chain of blocks. It is not rocket science. You know, Git, I mean, I love the example Git. People say, oh, but then is Git a blockchain? And my answer is, well, yeah, it's basically a blockchain. You know, it doesn't quite precisely match the linear chain of blocks and how we use it. But why Git is a set of hashed things in a directed acyclic graph is essentially the same reason why Bitcoin is a chain of blocks. You know, I want to make sure that my copy of the source code on my computer is the same as your copy. That's why Bitcoin is a blockchain. That's why Git has something nearly a blockchain.
What about privacy coins? I've seen you talk more about Zcash than say...
Sorry, proof of what?
Privacy coins.
Oh, privacy coins.
Yeah, so I've seen you talk about Zcash more than say Monero. Like, what's your position on privacy coins?
I mean, they make a lot of sense if they work. You know, the only reason I want to talk more about Zcash and Monero is Monero has less wrong with it.
Okay.
You know, Monero definitely could, in theory, have less privacy than Zcash. You know, the underlying idea of what Monero is certainly has potential for less privacy than Zcash. But the Monero people have just done a competent job implementing something with very little drama, and the people behind it seem pretty ethical. And there's very little to criticize about Monero.
Mm-hmm. It's the only other crypto I hold. I've got Bitcoin and Monero.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I hold essentially trivial quantities of Monero and Zcash, you know, enough to use it on occasion. But in theory, Zcash should be better. Its privacy, the potential for privacy is much better.
Is that because it uses ZK Snarks?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, the difference is in Monero, your payments might have come from, you know, immediately one of, say, 10 different people, and then, of course, you know, 100 and so on. Whereas in Zcash, the moment you do a payment, if it's a shielded payment, you're now part of this big anonymity set. What's wrong with Zcash is sort of all the implementation details and sort of the people behind it.
Well, so I interviewed Zuko last week, and one of the most important questions I think I put to him is, I said, is Zcash a company? Because that's what it feels like. It feels like it's a company.
Yeah, it is, effectively.
And
the reality is the way they do Zcash is very explicitly centralized. You know, they kind of try to put fig leaves on it, but reality is it's a company of a few different people with really dubious ethics. You know, it's kind of fortunate because it's a scary thing to have. You know, the best privacy tech out there for that type of use case run by people who will lie to you.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised that it seems like the Winklevoss brothers have a preference for Zcash. It didn't surprise me.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing I think with it is people in that kind of sphere, they would rather work with people who are not totally ethical. You know, this, like, I get the sense this is why Coinbase and Zcash kind of seem to get along, because they kind of see eye to eye on, well, you know, we're not going to strictly tell everyone exactly how this really works. You know, we're happy to futz with stuff. I mean, when they did the trusted setup, the simple reality is they botched it. And rather than just come and say, look, here's where we made our mistakes, here's what we're going to do better, they just lied. You know, they said it was multi-party setup, and the reality is it wasn't. It was intended to be, but due to technical failures, I don't think you can make that claim. In the Bitcoin world, I think had that happened with the people behind Bitcoin, they would have said, look, we screwed up this, this, and this. We're going to fix this next time. Here's the timeline where we roughly want to do it. Here's why this isn't necessarily a big deal, et cetera, et cetera. You know, had Zcash simply done that, I think Zcash would still be a success. But that's not the way they think. They think, well, you know, shit, we got to have good PR on this. You know, we got to preserve our, you know, money coming in. And after all, I mean, they get a ton of money from Zcash. They have incentives to hide flaws because that's their income. Whereas, you know, the more long-term view would be, well, all right, we might lose some money in the meantime while we lose some market confidence, but the long-term effect will be people actually trust us. I don't trust Zuko not to lie to me.
Yeah, I've got to say I trust Ricardo a bit more.
Yeah.
You're a big fan of Ripple Coin, right?
Well, I think Ripple's a wonderful idea. You mean Ripple, the original concept of like peer-to-peer payments, right?
I'm on about Ripple Coin.
Yeah, that's remarkably scammy.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So I, at one point, worked for R3.
Okay.
And I should be careful what I say here because there's probably NDAs and they're a bit, they aren't very happy with me. But long story short, I think what I can say is initially I was working as a consultant, you know, evaluating other coins and other systems. And I think their business plan there was, let's just go buy something and let's package it up and sell it to banks. Perfectly reasonable thing to do, you know, act as middleman. Well, they had me analyze Ripple because at the time there's a lot of interest among banks. And I analyzed it and said, yeah, this centralized system, obviously, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. For banks, I think that would have been fine. Of course, I soon found out they weren't saying it was centralized banks. They were just flat out lying about what it actually was. So when I did a big presentation in front of most of the world's major banks and representatives from them, they're like, wait, Ripple's what? Because they've been lied to. You know, and Ripple these days, I don't actually get the sense that's true anymore. I get the sense that Ripple, the company, has become much more reasonable. But Ripple's tied to a currency. And they don't have any ability to get rid of this currency, which doesn't really, it isn't needed for technical reasons. So I think they're put in a very awkward position where this rabid fan base of bag holders, essentially.
Very strange group.
Yeah. Very, very strange. And I would not be surprised if, like as an example on Twitter, you know, you say something, Nate, about Ripple and the XRP troll army comes down on you. I would not be surprised if, for the most part, that sort of army of crazy people is actually not that involved with Ripple, the company, selling things to banks. You know, I don't think they're that dumb, but they can't get away with it. You know, there's no mechanism for Ripple, the company, to actually extract, you know, themselves from the currency. Like it or not, they created the currency. They own a big chunk of it. They can't get away from that. And I mean, this is one of the real dangers of creating coins for services. You might get tied to a coin that's pointless.
Well, that's why I call it Ripple Coin. I never changed from Ripple Coin because I think it's important for people. It was like with Bitcoin Cash becoming Bcash. Like the alternative name, I think, was important. I always call it Ripple Coin because I think people have to know. They have to know it was created by the company, that it wasn't a gift.
And worse than that. I mean, last I checked, and God, I mean, I haven't looked recently, the consensus was still controlled by the Ripple company. You can't get away from the fact Ripple's architecture is centralized. You know, the XRP community can say all they want, but, oh, you know, it's just nodes. You can go pick a different set. Well, yeah, I mean, I can go pick a different currency. You know, unless you and I agree on the same set of nodes, the reality is we're not looking at the same currency. And that was really all my paper was. I just pointed out, yeah, obviously, if you pick a different set of central nodes controlling the consensus than me, we can get out of consensus and all hell will break loose. Thus, the only sane thing to do is pick the same set of servers to control the consensus.
One thing I do want to ask you about is because I think one thing a lot of other alternative currencies have managed to do, whether it's right or wrong, but by design have been able to create an incentive structure and financial incentives for developers. Bitcoin is still largely voluntary, or there are some contributions in different ways. I know you've had a contribution, but it's
Bitcoin is not voluntary in the sense that developers go unpaid. It's voluntary in the sense that the currency itself isn't directly paying developers.
Of course, yeah.
But the reality is there's enough money floating around for developers to get paid. You know, even total screw-ups like me.
Are you still working on Bitcoin?
I'm not working on Bitcoin Core.
Right.
But I am working on projects around it, like OpenTime, Samson, Proof Marshall.
Okay.
And I've had surprisingly good success getting paid for that.
I guess it depends who you are, though, and the reputation you've built. You can be funded. But when you say there is funds available for developers, how do they go about receiving funds? How do they do it?
I mean, it's kind of like anything. You do a bit of work, you show that you're competent, and you find someone who's interested in paying you to do more work. You know, if you're competent and you prove that, the simple reality is there are ways to go get money. It is not the hardest part. The hardest part is getting to the point where you're competent. And, you know, the distinction I'd make is even in coins which have developer funds, getting money out of those developer funds is surprisingly hard.
Right, okay.
Like, Zcash is a great example where the Windows clients for Zcash were completely unmaintained because Zcash wasn't giving them any money.
Okay, so... because I saw, like, say, with Luke put up his Patreon, and I supported him, it just feels like there should be almost like something he shouldn't have to worry about.
Well, I mean, the simple reality is having funds, you know, in these coins is not a magic solution to that either.
Hmm.
You know, the bigger problem is more you getting to the position where you're doing interesting work that's getting valued. And if you're able to do that and actually contribute, getting that money is not that hard.
Is there enough developers coming through? Because we talked about earlier about enough of the kind of biggest and brightest minds who can really think adversarially or think outside the box. But are there enough developers coming through who can just work on more simpler tasks?
You know, the impression I get is mostly yes. But the interesting thing about this is like Bitcoin Core itself, that actual core software. I may not be very popular saying this, but I think it's true that they've got but enough developers, you know, maybe a little too many. You know, Bitcoin Core itself doesn't necessarily need to change that much, you know, and it can change on a somewhat slower basis than it has. I mean, it's not really a big concern. The more interesting thing is like all the periphery infrastructure around it. You know, things like libraries that actually work and are well-documented and so on. And that's not very sexy work. So that may actually be the thing where we need more money put into. But when you look at other coins which do have developer funds, they don't do a good job of this either. So it's not like this is a magic solution that's proven to work. This seems to be more a solution which is proven to make the people who founded the coin a ton of money.
Yeah, I spoke to Brian Bishop, and I think he says something along the lines of, it would be great if some parts of the code start to become compartmentalized because it's kind of a big sprawling mess right now. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, the fundamental like Bitcoin Core architecture is not, I think, how you would do it these days. I think in the context of when it was created, it was probably the right decision to make. You know, do this very simple thing which one person can create and one person can comprehend. And it's just one code base that's very easy to review. But for what we want it to do now, it's probably not ideal. On the other hand, I mean, people often think, oh, you know, Bitcoin Core doesn't have this feature. It's terrible. Well, so what? Just run a Bitcoin Core node, grab the data from it, and do whatever you need to do. You know, what do you need to do? You need to have an index of transactions. Just follow the blocks and index your transactions. It's slightly less efficient, but so what?
You're one of those people who kind of wants the base chain to essentially... Was it ossify? Is that the word they use?
The base protocol is pretty stable. Not quite as stable, say, TCP/IP, but it's reasonably stable. And equally, so is the stability TCP/IP held back the internet? I don't think you'd make that case at all.
Mm.
If anything, it's helped it by having this simple thing that works, and you can build on top of it.
I want to ask you a bit about the work you've been doing. But before that, just one kind of, I say one final question. I haven't got through hardly anything here. This has been great. But I do want to ask you about your views on fungibility. Because in doing my interviews, I've kind of had two different perspectives. There's some people who do want like a fungibility on the base chain. But there is someone like Safedean wouldn't. Safedean's view is that we want a a completely transparent base chain, so we can ensure nobody is operating with, fractional reserves. Like, where do you sit in that kind of field?
I think his viewpoint is technically ignorant there. You can definitely have, I mean, as an example, ideally Zcash would be completely non-transparent. In reality, it's nearly entirely transparent because you actually using the shielded transaction features is hard and discouraged. But in theory, Zcash could be completely shielded. And even then, it'd still be easy to be transparent. You know, the better argument to make there is all the technology for privacy on base chains is potentially dangerous.
Okay.
You know, example being with Zcash, you have that trusted setup. That trusted setup could easily fail. Implementation bugs could easily cause it to fail. In fact, the fundamental Zcash library, you know, the thing that verified transactions, just prior to release, they found a bug in it that could have allowed unlimited inflation. And that's not even like a trusted setup failure. It's just a simple bug in it. And it's not an easy bug to find. You know, you really got to understand math in very deep detail to find something like that, because you're relying completely on the math to protect you from inflation. Whereas in Bitcoin, you're relying on stuff, you know, you could explain to a drunk art student. Speaking of, I have a fine arts degree, so I'm a little biased there. I like this level. But, you know, that's useful because it means tons of eyes can see this stuff. You know, when Bitcoin had this recent inflation exploit.
CVE bug.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Had that actually been used, chances are alarm bells would have gone off in tons of places because people are looking at doing the math, figure out how many Bitcoins are in existence. Does this number make sense? You know, any idiot can do that. It's not hard. For Zcash, to do that, you need to re-implement all ZK snarks, and it is a nightmare.
So, I guess you're keen on some form of fungibility, but are you keen on it, say, as a sidechain or some kind? Like, how?
Well,
are you,
I mean, Lightning adds that. Yeah, any add-on to Bitcoin that's scalable will naturally have better fungibility. And the reason is, to scale, you have to distribute less data to less people.
Right.
You know, it is just not possible to create a scaling solution that doesn't at least add privacy to some adversary. You know, as an example, Coinbase. Let's suppose, well, PayPal. Let's go really out there. Mm-hmm. PayPal, compared to Bitcoin, has better privacy against most adversaries. If I pay someone with PayPal, you know, North Korean spies don't know what I did. Obviously, the U.S. government probably has a full copy of everything, mm-hmm. but most of my adversaries now do not know that I made that payment and have no way of knowing. You know, that is categorically better than Bitcoin from that narrow perspective. If my adversary is the U.S. government, totally different discussion, but PayPal scales. And the only way it could scale is by reducing the data available to the bad guys.
Okay. All right, look, we've done a lot here, but I do want to cover some of your work. So, when I spoke to Giacomo, he was like, Peter's really busy working on Proof Marshall. I don't know anything about it. Can you tell me, what is Proof Marshall?
Well, all right. So first of all, my simpler project is open timestamps. And open timestamps proves data existed in the past. Mm-hmm. The problem with open timestamps is it doesn't prove anything about whether conflicting data also existed. Example being, I sell you a house. I give you a signed digital document saying, I, owner of, you know, 1234 Main Street, sell it to you. What you don't know is if I already sold that house to someone else. Proof Marshall fixes that problem by, you know, it's a library to create data structures where you have consensus over. And what consensus means there is simply, in the definition of selling a house, all the possible places where I could have put that data, you now can see. Thus, you can rule out me selling the house to someone else. And how do you do that? Well, you throw in a whole bunch of Merkle trees and hashing. Yeah, this is, I mean, what's hard about Proof Marshall is that the strategy for the implementation is effectively taking pointers and abstracting that concept. You know, pointers are such a low-level fundamental idea in computer science that just, you know, the low-level mechanics of actually implementing this is challenging and tricky to do well. And you get a lot of issues like, you know, if I'm giving you a math proof that now you own this house, I want to make sure that even if the coder writing that application isn't that careful, that math proof won't, for instance, use up all the memory in your system. Turns out that's actually a hard problem. You know, it's not a hard problem for like Bitcoin level reasons. You know, this is an economics problem. It's just, it's a tough thing to implement at a computer science level. Or maybe I'm just not a very good coder.
So what's your status? Where are you at with the project?
Oh, 2 weeks for sure.
Oh, right. Or is that devs week?
No, I mean, truthfully, it's something where I always thinking, all right, I could finish this in 2 months. But 2 months later, I didn't realize about this, and this. You know, I mean, as an example, the first version I had for how it would represent, you know, how it would abstract a pointer made the assumption that you always hash the data. And I did a bunch of work on that. I realized, that doesn't actually work. You know, that causes other technical problems that, long story short, this doesn't work.
Right, okay.
You know, another example was I had my most recent implementation had a thing where when you took the data and processed it and deserialized it, you would make a copy of it. And I naively thought, that's not a big deal. Make the copy of it. It's all well and good. Of course, I go through the adversarial thinking where I say, because I made a copy of this, now my API doesn't have a good way of ensuring I don't run out of RAM because of all these extra copies. Mm-hmm. So I had to effectively redesign it so that all the data can be operated on sort of directly. You know, if you're a programmer, the term I'd say is the serialized version of it is identical to what you would process in main memory. Thus, you don't have to make a copy to process it. You know, and this is all like very much in the weeds technical stuff, but to make a robust implementation that works well, you have to solve these problems. You know, and it's just hard. And because it's still at such a fundamental level of design, having two people work on it at once is very challenging.
Okay.
You know, because if I make a change, I'm usually changing how any of the code works. And now if I have a partner working with me, suddenly everything they're doing is broken. You know, maybe if I was sitting next to a guy in an office, this might go faster, but it's just not there. And
it's a one-man project.
Yeah, for now. But, you know, if it works, it'll eventually work. And long story short, it'll be a nice library to write consensus applications to do all kinds of things you want. You know, as an example, you could even implement Git in ProofMarshall to just have a good way of making sure you and I have the same copy of code. You know, certificate transparency is another example. When you go to a website, the certificate that proves you're talking to the computer you think you're talking to, you know, like your bank, for instance, that's published in a blockchain. The people who create certificate transparency, of course, hate the term blockchain and probably would strangle me if I said this in front of them. But the reality is the data structure is effectively a blockchain. In ProofMarshall, you could do things like that. And all right, you can do them now, but it's just a lot less work when you have a library that just does it for you. You know, it's like, I mean, SQL databases are like this. Sure, prior to the invention of SQL, you could, in theory, do anything you do with it. But it's just so much more work to get there.
I think I've kept up with about a good 50% of today.
Well, that's enough to do a 51% attack.
I don't want to do that. I don't want a 51% attack you. We're just going to have to do another one another day because there's so much more I want to talk to you about. But there are a couple of two kind of final closing things I want to talk to you about. One's just a bit left field. I've noticed you tweet quite a bit about journalism. Why does that get to you so much?
You know, I think this really comes down to, you know, this is an example of not staying in your lane. You know, this kind of phrase going around, you know, stay in your lane, only talk about the stuff that, you know, you're supposed to do professionally and so on. I really don't care about that for Twitter. And a lot of that gets down to, well, what does it take to have a society that functions? You know, you have to have people agree on basic facts around the world. And I think the reason why I'm critical of that, same reason ultimately I'm critical of many scams in the crypto world, where people are saying things about their projects that just aren't true and polluting the ecosystem of ideas with false things. You know, and unfortunately right now, we have a big problem with journalism where, first of all, it's not very fun. You know, it's not well funded. There just isn't that money to actually pay journalists to do their job properly. You know, I have quite a few friends who are journalists, and I see this every day. I mean, the timelines they have to operate on are ridiculous. There's no way for them to do a good job, given how fast they have to put out articles with how little help. And on top of this, to make money, you wind up with all kinds of dark practices like clickbait.
Yep.
And when you combine that with the very ugly political landscape of the U.S., you get really ugly things like Covington, where I think it's pretty fair to say major media organization, oh, this is a great story, fits our narratives really well, we're going to get a ton of clicks on this, let's rush to publish before anyone else does. And the rush to publish is a really big deal. You know, I've been told directly by people managing media organizations in the crypto space that collectively people like me are a huge competitor to them because I can tweet faster than they can publish. And literally minutes matter in this stuff. You know, if they're not first to publish, they will get less clicks, less views, less money. Like, it sounds so stupid, but this is the truth of it. And that pushes a cycle that just doesn't allow for good research and good work. You know, and unfortunately, there's not easy ways to stop this. You know, like maybe one of the solutions could be more use of defamation laws and libel and so on. But there's very, like, very, very real risks to this with freedom of speech.
Yeah, I mean, my last interview that went out yesterday was Andrew Torber from Gab.com.
Yeah.
What do you think of Gab? I mean, the content is, you know, tasteless. But do you agree that...
You know, I've never actually looked at Gab's website itself. And I'm kind of sympathetic to them. I mean, I think organizations like that should be able to exist. I think the fact that they've been deplatformed from payment providers is a straight-up antitrust issue. You know, and they're not the only example of this. I mean, the fact of the matter is companies like PayPal, MasterCard, and Visa are able to restrict freedom of speech very effectively. Not as effectively as they could without, say, things like Bitcoin, but the amount of control they have over what content gets produced is very scary. Like, where deplatforming ends up is people being able to restrict speech. Because they can say, I don't like what you're publishing, and we're going to cut off your money. And, you know, you can't, for instance, do journalism without access to a flow of money to go pay people to do stuff. And this is a very, very real issue. You know, what Patreon has done is scary. Now, as a libertarian, I'd say Patreon itself, I don't have issues with them cutting off people. What I have issues with is the payment providers who've now said, oh, you're trying to compete with Patreon? We're going to cut you off as well. That's where I think this crosses the line into getting very scary as a society. So, again, do I support Gab itself? Yeah, whatever, let them do what they want. But do I support fighting back at why Gab is unable, you know, has a hard time running a business? That's what matters to me.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just not that concerned about people spreading hate on the internet. I don't think that's actually a big concern for society, particularly when we go see the left doing exactly the same thing, but in a different context. You know, there's no, like, clear, you know, moral high ground here. And obviously, if the left can do this and society hasn't collapsed, it's not necessarily such a bad thing. You know, and in some ways, that kind of thing pisses me off more because I definitely identify as a liberal.
Well, yes, I do it sometimes. But I was saying to Andrew that, like, politically, I've got no idea anymore where I am because I'm finding so much to dislike about everyone.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And that there's, I'm like, and there's, but also there's certain conservative things I do like. And then there's certain kind of liberal things I like. And I'm just so confused. I don't know where to position myself.
I mean, my entire adult life, and you know, I live in Canada, and my entire adult life, I voted for the Liberal Party, which in Canada, the Liberal Party is what the name suggests. It's the Liberal Party. You know, these days, I'm not sure I identify with them anymore. I'll probably still wind up voting for them because they're the best of bad options. But, you know, and I think part of it, too, is like many of the social issues I do care about, you know, like freedom of speech and gay rights and so on. A lot of that's actually been kind of solved. Abortion's legal in a lot of places. Gay marriage is legal. The things that I cared about, we solved those problems.
Through free speech.
You know, I mean, just through like the way politics moved. Conservative parties eventually, all right, fine, we'll go along with this. And then probably isn't gonna, at least in Canada, it's probably not going to get reversed. So now it's like, oh, do I need to go vote for liberals again? I mean, the things they were fighting for got solved. The things that they're now fighting for, I don't agree with. It's a very strange situation to be in.
I think we could do a whole show on this. All right, just to close out, we've had 10 years of Bitcoin. So we look back, looking forward over the next 10 years, what are the key things you would like to see happen? And what are the most important things, not just in terms of code and development, but just overall for Bitcoin? What's going to be important?
Well, I'll give you a very specific answer, which is the things I'm working on with client-side validation, like Proof Marshall, I think are critical to moving this stuff to the next step. You know, getting past this narrative of, oh, we need some Ethereum chain where everything's in one place, which we know just doesn't work. You know, I think smart contracts are actually really useful, but they're not useful done in the way Ethereum people want to do them. You know, it doesn't work technically. So yes, this is kind of a very narrow answer, but this is the stuff I'm directly working on. And I think that's a very fertile ground for making new and interesting things. You know, and beyond that, I mean, I'm sure the Lightning crowd and so on will do great work in making payments better and so on. But, you know, and the store of value stuff, just not screwing up is enough to make that possible. So that's kind of my answer there.
Great. This was utterly fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Okay, so what did you make of that? How great is Peter? I loved the whole story of him talking to Adam Back and Hal Finney, but I also appreciate his thoughts on other cryptocurrencies. People who have been listening to the show for a long time will know that I've been feeling the gravity of Bitcoin, and I've definitely been starting to have some doubts and concerns with other cryptocurrencies, and I think the bear market has also exposed a lot here. So it was great to talk to Peter about this. It was great to hear his views and hear him articulate with the likes of Ethereum and Zcash the issues he's had. It certainly reinforced some of my thinking. So I hope you enjoyed it. As I said before, if you have any questions, do feel free to reach out to me. And again, thank you to everyone who supports the show. Anything you do, from leaving a review on iTunes to sponsoring the podcast, it all helps. But if you do want to help, there's a whole bunch of things you can do. So firstly, don't just skip the ads, listen to them. It's important that the advertiser get their message across. This helps me keep the podcast going. You can also become a patron. Head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. I've got 74 now. Ticks up every week. This is absolutely madness, but thank you to everyone who does it. I really appreciate you supporting the show. If you don't want to listen to the ads, you can subscribe there. It's $5 to get the show without advertising. If you don't want to use Patreon, you can subscribe by crypto. Drop me an email, I'll give you an address to send to, and I'll add you to the distribution list. You can also become a show sponsor. If you're interested in that, please email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Downloads are growing every month. It looks like January might be a record month. You can leave me a review on iTunes or click on the subscribe button. Both help with the ranking of the show. You can follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Medium. I'm at whatbitcoindid on everything. But my personal Twitter is @PeterMcCormack. DMs are open. Feel free to reach out. You can check out my website, which is www.whatbitcoindid.com. Loads more work being done to that at the moment. You can sign up to my newsletter. And you can also share the show out with your friends and family. Okay, I'm heading up to San Francisco. Now, going to record a couple of great interviews. I'm going to keep those quiet for now. I've also got my Izuko interview coming out soon. I just need to fix some sound issues I had on that. Okay, listen, hope you all have a great week. As I said, if you want to reach out to me, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I look forward to hearing from you.